inch by inch, row by row. Gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come tumbling.
Welcome to The Bannock Gardener, where every week we look at some aspect of organic and sustainable gardening or at a political or environmental issue that bears on those things. This week, we're going to be hearing about one organic farmer's story. And it includes loss of land, threatened loss of a second farm, and a battle with a major oil pipeline company. I'm Kate Gardner. Be sure to check out the parallel post on the blog at themannockgardener.com. Now, I've interviewed a number of different authors on this show, but this book is different because it's not at all a how-to book, although it certainly includes an awful lot of useful information about organic farming and gardening. But this is primarily a memoir and a deeply moving story about loss, work, connections to the family, farm, and other people. It's about fear. And ultimately, and thank goodness, it's about triumph. The book itself is Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. It's by Atina Diffley, who along with her husband and business partner, Martin, ran the Gardens of Egan Organic Farm, which has supplied a number of the co-ops in the Twin Cities in Minnesota with a large proportion of their vegetables for several decades. Welcome, Atina. I'm very pleased to have you here on The Bannock Gardener.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this book, of course, tells two stories, and you really might want to close your ears because I'm afraid I'm going to do great violence to a wonderful story in this extremely brief summary. But one of them, of course, is the loss of Martin's family farm. And then after you and your children find another farm and you're reestablished and you've had several successful years, that farm is threatened when one morning you open, I think it's three letters, telling you that a oil pipeline is slated to be laid across your land and eminent domain might mean that you have to comply. And of course, we'll get to those stories in somewhat more depth, I hope. But I wanted to start by mentioning that reading this book was for me an almost surreal experience because your farm was in Egan Township, south of the Twin Cities, and I lived in Northfield, Minnesota, in Rice County, just south of Dakota County, where you were, during some of the same period. And I was driving from Northfield along, sometimes on Route 3, right past your farm, and I had no idea what was happening there. And as I read this book, there were these just almost eerie moments of recognition. For instance, when you talk about a particularly horrific snowstorm on a Halloween when something like 2 feet of snow fell. And I thought, oh my gosh, I remember that snowstorm. I was carrying my toddler around on my back and holding my older son's hand as we went trick-or-treating, and you were trying to close up the farm stand and selling, the last of your misshapen pumpkins, I believe?
That was a great story because it was a pumpkin shortage that year. So we were actually selling pumpkins we would never have sold, but there really was not literally another pumpkin in five-county area.
Yeah. So good for you in one way, although it also meant you couldn't take down the stand in the normal way because everything froze. But
our lives were frozen at that point, so it was rather apropos.
Yes, and this is actually one of the things you do frequently in the book that, and I think quite beautifully that you create metaphors from the farming situations. And in this case, it was the frozen stand, the frozen lives. Yeah. But one of the things that struck me as I was reading it was, I'm driving through this farmland. I probably drove past your farm, and I had no idea what was going on. Why is it important for people to hear this story?
That's a really great question. What happened at our farm in Eagan and it being developed is not a unique story. It's happened all over the country, many different farms. Eagan itself was the market garden resource for the Twin Cities. There were many, many market gardeners there for 150 years, supplying food to the farmers markets and to the grocery stores and having delivery routes. Our farm was one of two that were left in Eagan at the point of the late 80s. So this is a story that has happened many times, and people just really haven't understood until pretty recently how important it is that we have food security and stability right there in our local communities.
And that we not zone everything out.
Yeah.
And lose even the ability to see somebody else doing it, at least, even if we aren't doing it ourselves.
Right now, we have a great opportunity because we have an economic downturn, and it slowed the development issues here in the Twin Cities and on much of the country. So it's a great opportunity to really rethink our urban design.
That's
and
so
ask what we want to preserve.
Yes, it's so interesting to think of the downturn as an opportunity. It's an opportunity in another way as well, because a lot of people are now interested in growing their own food.
A lot of people have turned to agriculture when they couldn't get a job and mm-hmm. found they loved it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, before we get to the stories themselves, which is, of course, the heart of this time and of your book, I do want to lay one myth to rest, if I can. Is it possible to make a decent living farming organically?
Yes, absolutely. Martin and I made a very good living farming. But we didn't make a good living in the 70s and 80s because there really wasn't a market. So part of the important aspect is to have a good market and to have good support in the market. It's real important that the farmer's professional and understands how to pack a quality product and be reliable. And then there also needs to be the right economy of scale, matching
the
farmer's skills. You know, every farm is going to have to be really different, because if you have a lot of land, you can wholesale and you can have certain economies that way. If you're a very small farm, it's going to be important to have more value added and have higher value crops if you don't have much acreage. So it's important to match the farm with the market and with the grower and with the land. I really think of a farm as a synthesis of the land, the people, and the business.
Yeah. And this, of course, is something that you say in the course of the book as well. And as you speak about this, you know, the business sense involved, you're, of course, also talking about some of what you do now professionally, now that you and Martin have sold the farm. But you are a consultant for other organic farmers. And so you're spreading the word and sharing your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Big step work.
Yeah. So now to your story, you had an earlier marriage, had you and your daughter found Martin, you and Martin found each other. You joined him on the land with Eliza in 1985, right?
That's right.
But he had been there for practically his whole life. In fact, he was the fourth generation Diffley to be there, I think.
Yeah, he was raised on the family land. There were four siblings still on the land. And at that point in time, it was owned by Martin's relatives, and he owned 1 acre where we had our house and roadside stand and our greenhouses, and then he rented the family land and took care of it.
But since he didn't own the land, he didn't have the final say about how it was disposed of, and in fact, but there was a much bigger entity that had the last final say in that, and that was the township, right?
Yeah, at that point it was a city, and they hadn't left any land zoned for agriculture.
which so meant...
The family for many decades had known that development was coming, and there really wasn't a lot they could do about it, was the family belief.
So when you joined him on the land, this was already known, this was the situation. You knew you were not going to be able to stay there forever.
That's true, yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah.
There's a passage that really struck me when I was reading, and I wonder whether you would read it to us. It's at the end of one of the earlier chapters, Spring's Fault, 1985, and it's Spring's Fault that you two, in fact, got into the planting again. You hadn't quite really decided to, but you ended up doing it. I love that. And
spring comes, and how can you say no? All that life popping around everywhere.
You just have to join in. Stick the plants in the ground. Yeah.
I think every gardener out there knows that feeling.
Yes, it's true. And many become gardeners because they can't resist it. So there at the end.
I would love to read this.
Good. Please.
Listening to this story, I finally understand.
Oh, excuse me. I'm going to interrupt just to explain that very first phrase, because you had spent a lot of the time in the early part of this book talking about how Martin, every time he picks up a tool or takes a step onto a particular path, he's telling the story and the history. And I love how you render your own ambivalence about this. You're interested, but it also seems, I don't know, overplayed to some extent. And this is the moment at which it clicks for you. Please, go ahead.
I'd love to. Thanks. Listening to this story, I finally understand why Martin is always talking about everyone's history. I had thought the expression good connections meant knowing people in high places, but it's the clerk in the grocery store, the farmer down the road with manure, the teller at the bank. This is what creates a secure community. Being rooted on land taught his family relationship, and food is the oldest connection and strongest bond of all. I'm constantly aware that impending development is like a noose around his neck, and he never knows when it will tighten. But times like this, the rope seems to be completely dissolved. We start walking along the ridge. The light is long and low now. Our shadows fall 100 feet into Cottonwood Valley below. Our shadow hands reach out and pick blooming violets. Scented essence of yellow and purple in the falling light. We bring them to our shadow mouths to nourish our spirit selves with the flower sugar shadow of dusk. Our spirits touch things our bodies cannot. They stretch and expand, fly up to meet the sky.
Thank you. That's beautiful. When I read it, I was just overwhelmed by the loveliness of the language. We bring them to our shadow mouths to nourish our spirit selves with the flower sugar shadow of dusk. Thank you for sharing that gift. And now to the story, which is quite a story. The first part of it, of course, is the horror of losing that family land. And it was not a single, snap of the cord that binds. Rather, went on and on, that loss.
It was really like being a frog put in cold water and having the heat turned up.
Oh, no.
We've used that one a lot.
I see.
There was really no just anything but going through it.
Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, first, the school district needed 20 acres of the 120, and the family couldn't say no to that. And that brought the sewer and water across the rest of the land to serve the school, which brought sewer and water assessments to the rest of the land.
And how do those assessments work?
Well, they don't have to be paid until the land is sold. So hypothetically, you could just decide not to sell the land and never pay them. But never ever is a fairy tale. And reality is that there's 11% interest, so in 7 years... The assessment is double. In this case, the assessment was around $350,000. So in 7 years, the family would owe $700,000. In 14 years, they'd owe $1.4 million. In another seven, it'd be $2.8 million.
So you're
talking
really
now. So it's really a ticking time bomb. It's really a ticking time bomb.
So that 1.4 is 1.4
million.
Million.
And then in another 7 years, it would be 2.8 million.
So this is like pressure to sell. The longer you keep...
Oh, it's a real noose around the neck, which is why I said that in the book.
Yeah.
And so the family has to look at that and say, if we don't sell at the right time, we're going to owe more than the land is worth. And it historically happens frequently where if a family doesn't sell, the market changes, there's eminent domain, and they sell, and they do have a debt. And that is this really difficult decision for family members to make. There's often multiple family members having to make the decision, so then you end up with different people wanting different things. These decisions are never simple for families.
No, it couldn't be.
No. So in this case, the family did sell. And we continued to farm the land until it was developed. But it meant that as they came in and do the development, they removed all life from the land. All the trees, all the grass, all the forbs. This was a very diverse farm. There was only about 35 tillable on 120. And all that biological diversity that just naturally existed still, it had never been removed. That was how we managed our pests as an organic farm, through the life that lived in those areas. And as they removed all of the life, we experienced a complete ecological collapse.
Tell us what that means. What did you see?
Well, we never had pest issues before the development because they were managed by that diversity. And once that life was gone, the birds were gone, the frogs were gone, the habitat for the beneficial insects were gone. All of a sudden, we had terrible pests. When it would rain, there was no life on the adjoining land to absorb the moisture, and so the soil would run off into our fields, and we would suffer from erosion.
Could you tell the story about the potato field?
Oh, that was a very sad one.
Yeah, if you can bear to.
The bulldozers came in. I love telling these stories because they're very important lessons.
Yeah.
The bulldozers came in, and they took out the adjoining hill.
But before that happened, you went out there that day. Right? And you were admiring your potatoes. and tell us...
I never thought they would develop the hill because I thought it was too steep. And I was very naive and young, and I didn't understand how powerful their bulldozers were. It was one of the more powerful spots on the farm. The family called it Devil's Hill.
Yeah.
And we just never imagined that they would develop it because it was so wild and rustic. I just thought it was sort of protected by its sacredness.
And
took all the life off it. They scraped the surface of it. And then we had a heavy rain, so the entire hill washed into the potato field. And we literally had 14 inches of sand and gravel on top of a potato crop.
At which point, I mean, the potatoes were tiny anyway, but originally you thought, okay, they're not going to grow. The plants are destroyed, but we can dig out the potatoes. Why couldn't you?
Oh, they were destroyed. We couldn't even find them. They were buried. But you know what's really funny about that story? And I tried to do this in the book, is to always bring in the humor. The developer's name was Ryan. He was Irish. Martin knew his story. They came with the Irish potato famine. And he didn't know potatoes grew underground.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was just extraordinary. But there was another very funny spot there, too. This was actually a field. I'm sorry. But this is a field that you were renting from a neighbor, an old woman named Louise, who lived alone, right? And Martin,
yeah.
Who is clearly a very, very nice and sweet person. Tell us what he told Ryan.
Well, the field at this point was originally part of the original Diffley farm, and it was sold, it was just a half an acre, to Louise when Martin's father built a home and sold that land with it. So they had been neighbors for many generations, and Louise was like a grandmother to her children. And, you know, for Martin going through this, he had been charged with the care of the land by his uncles.
Mm.
And so... as a young male, he couldn't have articulated this at the time, but the emotion he was feeling was he had failed in his generation. It was his turn to take care of the family land, and he wasn't able to do so.
Oh, wow.
So the grief that he was suffering was so multi-layered because he's really a protector and a caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt the need to protect us, his family, and to protect the land, and he couldn't do any of it. But he could protect Louise, so he told the developer Louise was the witch of the neighborhood and that she'd whipped her sons and that they'd both been in jail and that if he was the developer, he would settle up with her real quick. And the developer did.
So he said that the sons were going to come after him, and oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I stood there and listened and like, why is he saying this? But I understood later when the developer came through and paid Louise for the damages he had done. And they didn't want to pay. They didn't believe they should pay us for our potato crop.
Yeah, they offered you first as much as they would have offered for a field of conventional potatoes.
Well, at first they weren't even going to pay because he thought it was part of his land. He didn't even know where his property boundaries were. And our lease agreement at that point was with the developer. We were renting land from the developer, and our lease agreement said that they would not be liable for any damages caused by the development.
Uh-oh.
So in his mind, that was his land, and so he wasn't liable. Fortunately, it wasn't his land, but we lost other fields to the development, and they weren't liable. It was in the lease agreement.
Yeah.
That was the kind of arrogance they had about the entire project. And they're taking out of the trees. The entire thing was a very arrogant act. They didn't recognize what was there. The city of Eagan didn't recognize the property as a land use that was valuable, as a farm. The developer didn't recognize the life that was on the land as having a value, contributing to the wellness of the community far beyond the food that was being produced there, as far as the services that were being provided by the trees and the birds and all of the life that lived there.
Exactly. And first there's the business of not recognizing the value of the farm. Beyond that, there are mature stands of woods there, which I would have thought would have added, you know, considerable value to the development that they're putting in. There are rolling hills. These are not escarpments. And you say they leveled them, making the land much less interesting.
Those hills. Now, this is why the story is so important. We have come a long way since then. In the last 20 years, there is a lot more awareness around what needs to be preserved. As a society, we are talking about food security and stability, and we understand that food needs to be produced closer to where it is consumed. These are important issues of our day, and this story will help people really understand why it matters, because they're going to feel it.
Yes.
The way I wrote it is emotional for the reader. They're going to feel the loss themselves.
I think you can count on that.
Yeah. When people feel, then they make a change.
Yeah. Yeah. This is
their intellect.
The other thing is that the imagination feeds the intellect. We can only act on something we can imagine. And this allows us to visualize, to imagine, to understand. And that's an essential part of thinking, and I think an undervalued one.
Mm-hmm. So it's really the gift the land gave.
Yeah.
For future change. And what we're seeing happening now is very exciting. There's so much awareness around this. We're going to see big change in the next 10 and 20 years.
Yes, and thank goodness. Could you say something about the effect of this incremental loss on the children who had grown up there?
Well, I've talked about the ecological loss, but there's also the spiritual loss. And in some ways, that was a bigger piece than the ecological loss. And my children still haven't recovered. We're talking 20-some years ago now. But they had, as all young children, such a strong spiritual connection to the land. They were there with us, whether we were planting or harvesting. They were with us all the time. We weren't just a farm family. We were a family farming. They grew up at our roadside stand. They knew what we did. They knew what we valued. They knew what we stood for. They knew where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And they, everywhere we worked, had a special spot. Sometimes it was just a tree. It might have been a rock or a piece of grass. But these were holy spots to them that they really connected to, and that they were able to see creation in the making there. The farm was their school. It was their sanctuary. It was where they got in touch with the divine.
And then what happened?
And so for the children, they experienced far too young that their parents couldn't prevent bad things from happening.
Yeah.
They were 3 and 6, 7 when it started. And the loss was so severe. My two children reacted very differently. My daughter was 7 or 8, and she withdrew. She developed classic rape victim symptoms.
What does that mean?
Of becoming a compulsive, she became a compulsive cleaner. She refused to engage with the land, with the farm. She wouldn't even go out to the roadside stand. She basically stayed in the house and wanted to stay very clean. She would vacuum multiple times a day.
Really?
A child who just loved being outside and knew everything about the farm, could tell you every special spot on the farm. And my son became very violent and aggressive. He was basically acting out the violence that he was experiencing in the world around him.
Yeah. You have
He came through it better because he expressed it. Mm. And when we got to our new farm, he reattached. He allowed his loss. He allowed himself to feel his loss and reattached to the new farm and moved on. But my daughter didn't reattach.
Yeah, that's painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just so that people aren't in total agony about this, as far as I can...
I got over it.
Well, she did, you know, become a whole person in the end. She is married. She has children. She's a nurse. She has a life.
Great. She's 30 years old, and her children love our farm just like she loved our farm when she was a child.
Does she still live near you?
Yeah, she lives about 20 minutes away.
Yeah, yeah.
That's come over regular with her children. She has 3 children.
Yeah, that's near for the United States.
Yeah.
So there's an extraordinary section where you talk about the effect on your son. And I actually wonder whether he recovered more easily because he was younger and so the emotions were raw or it was easier for him to express them.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to handle them in some way.
Yeah.
I've read, for instance, that children under age of 6 who are lost in the wild have a better chance of surviving than children from age 6 and up. There's a dividing point right there. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. I'm really way out of my territory here. But anyway, could you say a little bit more about the effect on your son and how he started to act out? Because some of his behavior was just so out of character.
Well, my favorite part of that story is
the humorous one.
He would hide in the apple tree and throw potatoes at the customer.
Not good.
And he would run around the stand and take bites out of food and put them the bite side down.
Which is not like
Imagine
him.
Imagine watermelons and just general destruction.
Yeah. Yeah. But then one day, there was the little old lady.
Yes, and she didn't tolerate having a potato thrown at her. She picked up one and whipped it right back at him.
And hit him too, right?
You know, he jumped out of that tree and ran into the house crying. But did take care of the potato throwing for a little while.
I have to say, you know, if they stuck that in a movie, everyone would say, oh, yeah, Hollywood. But it's just
Well,
marvelous.
I tell you, there's a lot of things in the book that I thought, well, you know, I can't put that in there because nobody's going to believe it. But that's how life is. You don't have to write fiction. Life itself is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So the children were really profoundly affected, and you know, and fields that were destroyed before the bulldozers ran over, you know, came to them. And actually, one of the first things that you talk about there, when the first bit of land went to the school, I think it is, you go out and the bulldozers have been pulling. You know, there's a certain designated area they're supposed to be working in, but they've gone well outside that, and they've been turning around in your fields where things are growing.
Yeah, they really didn't understand that something was there. They didn't see a vegetable farm as... They just saw it as open space.
extraordinary. I'm speechless.
This was also before farmers were heroes. You know, nowadays we have a whole culture going praising our farmers and thanking them, especially our organic and local farmers, and calling them heroes. We were not heroes in the 1980s. Farmers were still considered dung of the earth.
Huh.
Not smart, dirty.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah, well, anybody who reads this book is going to have to rethink that one.
I wrote that in such a great way because when the reader reads it, they say, that's not true. Farmers aren't dirty. And they don't even realize it, but they're contradicting their own societal stereotype. And so they negate it. It's really exciting. I've seen it happen again and again with the reader.
Well, farmers might be dirty some of the time. They do work in the dirt. I mean, I'm a gardener and I get really dirty. And one of the things I've watched is how my tolerance for various things, you know, has changed as I became more and more committed to gardening and more committed to organics. And things that might have bothered me, and you know, don't. And sometimes I see somebody, you know, whom they do still bother, and it's an interesting contrast. But I'm glad you're regarded as a hero. You deserve to be. But I was laughing at the idea that you weren't smart also, which is pretty ludicrous. At any rate, I just think about, you know, the multiple losses, even your pets. You talk about your cat. Can you tell that story?
You know, that cat was amazing cat because she knew the whole farm and would travel the entire 20 acres. And once a piece of land was bulldozed, she wouldn't go on it again.
Mm.
So her range got smaller and smaller until it was down to her acre. And that was the first time she crossed the road, which she had never done because she had the farm to run. And then she got hit by a car. So there really was no room for life left in that setting. And as I've said before, that's why I wrote the book, is to really bring that story out so people think about why life matters and about this relationship that we have as humans with all of the life on the planet.
Yeah.
We take it really for granted. We don't think about what the tree outside our window is doing and how it's making our quality of life that much greater.
Yeah, I wrote a poem about that one, too, and when they finally came out with the research that having a tree outside the window helps patients recover more quickly, they need less pain medication, et cetera, if they can see
and
a tree.
It's so complex, you know, provisioning services, fresh air, fresh water.
Yeah.
It's endless, and we really take it for granted, but we would not exist without all of this life.
Yeah. Well, Let's jump ahead. You and Martin, after a long search, eventually do find another plot of really fine land, and you take care of it for the 3 years that are required to get it certified organic, during which time you are building the soil on it. You move there, you start farming there, you have excellent yields. Life is good. And then the day of the three letters. Let's talk about the second crisis here.
You know, this is a really important part of the story for the reader,
mm-hmm.
because the reader then understands how powerful they are and what a difference they can make. So in 2006, we were threatened by eminent domain by Koch Industries, one of the largest privately owned companies in the world. They wanted to run a crude oil pipeline to our second farm. Yeah, this was a different situation than the first one. For one thing, I owned it. The other thing, I was a lot more mature and had a really strong market. And I knew it was wrong. And I got online and read the criteria for route selection. And it was very clear to me that they were violating every single criteria if they ran across this farm. So it was an incredibly arrogant act. But they get away with it. People don't move pipelines. Yes, there's criteria for route selection, but they don't really follow them. They put them where they want. And that's what they told me when I called them.
Yeah. Because you thought, all I have to do is tell them we're here and here are the criteria for the route. all those criteria will be violated if they cross our land. I'll explain this. They'll go away.
Yeah, but it wasn't quite that easy.
No.
But this is where consumers and everyday citizens are so, so crucial. I started reading what was in place for an agricultural impact mitigation plan. And this is a document they have in place, the standard procedures of how they're going to put the pipeline in and then put all your soil back and fix everything up so that it's just like before, which is impossible. But what the criteria, what the agricultural impact mitigation plan said was they would not knowingly allow more than 12 inches of topsoil erosion.
As though it's okay to let 12 inches go. Any place except, you know, where you were there in Minnesota, 12 inches, there wouldn't be 12 inches of topsoil.
Can you imagine saying that to an organic farmer? 12 inches of topsoil erosion?
Yeah, we are going to talk about soil here.
I would have hit the roof if it said 1 inch.
1 second. We have got to talk about soil, but I have to clarify first that when you say the company's name, we better explain how it's spelled. Because this is not...
It's K-O-C-H.
Right.
Some people pronounce it cock. Some people pronounce it coke.
Yeah, I have heard coke, but we're not talking about the drink.
No, we're talking about the largest privately owned oil company, and they're also the largest manufacturers of synthetic nitrogen.
And why is that connection so important,
telling? That's a wonderful irony for me, since here we are, a small organic farm that provides our nitrogen by using soil-building plants and the energy of the sun, and we end up in court with the largest manufacturer of synthetic nitrogen. I thought that was a great irony.
I would agree. Yes. And of course, they're trying to move oil across your land, and the synthetic nitrogen is made from the oil. So I'd like to know what percentage of the oil we use in the United States is used on farms or is made into fertilizer and pesticides.
Well, fertilizer is usually made from natural gas, not crude oil.
Ah.
But farms are supposedly using 1/3 of our energy.
Mm-hmm.
And organic farms use only 40% of the energy that conventional farms use.
And by energy here, what are you counting?
It'd be multiple forms, whether it was natural gas, electricity.
So would that include fertilizers and pesticides or not?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's one of the areas where organic farms save their energy use, is in the fertilizers and the pesticides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the manufacturing processes that go into making them, the transportation costs for taking them place. It's a complicated journey. So tell us, we don't have, in fact, as much time left as I wish we did. And I want to be sure we really get through this story, because it was not, I'll tell them we're here and they'll go away. What did happen?
Well, after I read the 12 inches of topsoil erosion and called them, and they told me they're going to put it where they want, and if I don't like it, I can call the judge. I realized they needed an attorney.
Mm.
And I want to tell you that I got on the phone with a list of eminent domain attorneys in the Twin Cities area.
Mm-hmm.
I called attorney after attorney after attorney, and every single one told me the exact same thing. I'm sorry, we can't help you. We have a conflict of interest.
How many attorneys is this?
It's over 30. So, I actually don't have the list anymore. But I called nonstop for 5 days.
But what does this mean? That do you think that when Coke moves into an area, they simply get every relevant attorney on retainer so that nobody else can get one?
I can't say exactly what it means, because I didn't ask them if they were on retainer.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to have either served Coke in the past, mm-hmm. or were presently serving Coke, or one of their affiliates. Or they were on retainer. I mean, there's a number of things that could be happening there. I assume they were tied up. So that, to me, was really quite a profound moment when I realized how difficult it was for a landowner to even find an attorney to represent them.
Yeah. But you did.
I did find Paula McAbee. When I asked her why she wasn't tied up on a conflict of interest, she said she didn't represent polluters.
And when you described your situation, tell what
happened. Paula McAbee, this is the first thing she said to me. Gardens of Eagan Organic Farm? Crude oil pipeline? 12 inches of topsoil erosion? This is going to be fun.
And you thought, yes!
It was fun sometimes.
Yeah, you talk about realizing that you are an expert in the field and sitting down to write one of the most important documents in the whole process. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because I think you've already mentioned that the the company has a claim that they will mitigate any effects of their their activities on your land, but that you didn't find their mitigation plan sufficient.
It certainly didn't address organic farms. Paul and I set three goals. One was to move the pipeline over to the road and off of Garden's vegan land. Two, to avoid all organic farms on the route. There were five of them, whenever possible. And three, to write a mitigation plan that addressed organic farms' needs for soil and certification protection. And we were able to do all three. And
amazing.
We would not have succeeded if we hadn't had a couple of things. One, we were a certified organic farm.
Wait a minute. Before we get to the success, I want to stay in the struggle here for a minute longer.
Okay.
Why do you need a different mitigation plan for organic farms?
That's a great question. The present mitigation plan didn't recognize how organic farms build their soil and manage their fertility through the health of their soil and the biodiversity of their landscape. So those sort of protections have to be added into this mitigation plan. Organic farms can't simply come along and knife anhydrous or synthetic fertilizers into their soils to recover them and get a crop out after the soil has been put back in place.
And, of course, putting that nitrogen into the ground won't recover the soils, but it will get the crop out.
It's a little bit like running on steroids.
Yeah.
So the conventional farmer can produce that crop to some degree with those synthetic supports.
Yeah, whereas an organic farm cannot make that kind of quick recovery. It's
no,
not built that way.
It takes time to build soil and to get the microbial life back.
Yeah. Now, was it this group, was it Koch that said that they retained the right to use the topsoil while they had it, and then they would restore it afterwards?
One of the second item in the mitigation plan that caused my steam to come out of the top of my head was that they could use the topsoil for access ramps during the construction process.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, there's some compaction issues there.
Just a few. And what? But again, talk about this. Compaction means no oxygen. No oxygen means the microbial life is going to die.
You know, if you think about soil, an individual particle of soil is very, very tiny. It's really a dust. And if there wasn't microbial life in the soil, it would blow away very easily. It would erode very easily. So without it, without that microbial life, soil is very flat. Water can't enter it because there's no much space between the soil. It can't stay in there. There's no life to hold it. That microbial life is really crucial to the health of a living soil.
Mm-hmm. It binds the soil into the aggregates. It creates the soil structure that is so critical for good plant health.
That's right.
Yeah. And you use it for a little while under heavy machinery, and what happens to it?
That microbial life would have a pretty hard time maintaining as a viable community. You know, it's like any other community. The health of one affects the health of all. So when that soil is returned, that whole structure has to be rebuilt. That would take a good... in 5 years, maybe you could start to say it was reclaimed, but I think it would probably take 50 to 100 years to really reclaim it, if that. It's hard to know how long it would actually take.
Well, what if they didn't?
Another issue is that the pipeline keeps that soil warmer because of the moving oil. So it actually isn't conducive to the same microbial life.
Yeah.
After it's put back together.
Yeah. Well, what if they had just piled soil up. They didn't use it. They didn't run heavy machinery over it. What if they just scraped it, piled it, put it back?
It's certainly a better option, but mm-hmm. it's still going to have to be rehabilitated.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the fungal microbial life, like mycorrhizal fungi, they can't live very long if they don't have a root to grow on.
Explain mycorrhizae.
Mycorrhizal fungi are very exciting soil life because they grow out of the roots and expand the root mass by 2 to 6 inches, which really increases the capacity of the plant to bring nutrients and water into it. And as a fungi, it knits the soil particles together very nicely, holds a lot of moisture, does a lot for really good hydrology functioning in the soil. But it is dependent on roots to survive. Mm-hmm. So it's not very present in fields that spend the winters bare.
Uh-huh.
In a typical corn and soybean rotation where the crop comes off so late in the fall and then the fields are bare all winter, there isn't real good winter survival of those species. It's one of the reasons organic farmers want to keep their land covered at all times if possible.
Yes.
Maintain those microbial organisms.
Yeah. When I first heard of mycorrhizae, I wasn't sure it was real. I thought, oh, come on, you know.
Sounded like magic.
It did. It sounded like, oh, okay, you know, some hippie chick made this up.
Well, I have to tell you about what happened the first time I intentionally inoculated a pepper crop with it.
Yes.
I had read on Rodale's website that it increased yields by 50%.
You thought,
well, my yields were so heavy my plants fell over. And I had never understood why people would stake a pepper plant. It just didn't seem necessary.
Now you saw.
But I finally understood.
Yes.
So I actually had a lower harvestable yield that year because my plants didn't stand.
Oh, too funny. But if you're going to lose a crop, that's the right way to go.
So there's always a lot of learning experiences.
Yeah.
But I do really want to focus on what the citizens did.
Yes.
We wrote an organic mitigation plan. That's something Paul and I did. And we presented that to the Public Utilities Commission and to the Department of Agriculture. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture was wonderful. It's really important when you take on any sort of a policy change or political act like this that you really look for your allies and don't assume that some government agency isn't going to be your ally. There's great people working in all of these departments, and we certainly were supported by many of them.
That's wonderful.
And so we wrote an organic mitigation plan, and the other thing that really happened is that over 4,500 people wrote letters to the judge.
And Paula originally said to you, if you can get 200, I think that will impress the judge. And how many did you have the first week?
We had 1,100. And when she said that, she was speaking from her multiple experience with working on environmental issues and how hard it is to get people to write a letter.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't understand the connection that people have to food. And that is an incredibly powerful bond that people will act. It felt like a personal threat to them.
Yeah.
And those letters were amazing. I was blown away by how well those people understood soil and organic systems and the importance of protecting land. Our little farm was producing almost 3 million servings a year for our direct community. That's really important to have in a community. And it's not just the food, but that emotional relationship, multiple generations of families had eaten from this farm. It was a 35-year-old farm at that point. People really felt a loss themselves, and those letters made all the difference in the world because it showed in a court of law that our farm was not fungible, it was not replaceable for another of like kind, and how the pipeline company could compensate a farmer for its loss. But there was no way they could compensate thousands of people for their loss.
Yeah. And how big was your farm?
It's 100 acres and about 50 yard vegetables.
So only 50 acres?
Yeah, probably more like 40, 45 to 50.
Amazing.
And then about 20 was in soil building crops, and the rest was in biological diversity habitat.
Mm-hmm.
But the other really key thing to our success was our certification. A certified farm has an organic system plan where they detail out how they manage their farm with organic practices. And that is a federally registered document. So it had a great deal of credibility and power in a court of law.
Yeah.
It wasn't just anecdotal that we were using organic practices. We had been certified and inspected.
For decades.
1974. But that is really crucial, and I encourage farmers who are using organic practices to get certified for that protection, whether they're dealing with drift, eminent domain, any sort of legal issue. Being certified will make a really big difference for their ability to fight it.
Yeah, you know, one of the very interesting side notes here, if it is a side note, is that in the wake of your eventual success, neighbors would come to you and say, so about this getting certified organic business, because you now had protection once you had won your case that they couldn't get.
Yeah, and this organic mitigation plan has made it very expensive to cross an organic farm in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It costs about $25,000 a day now. So if they can avoid it, they are.
Yeah, yeah. So have some of those farms actually become organic?
Two farms in my community have gone organic since then, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't even using organic practices before. It wasn't just that they weren't certified. They actually transitioned to organic.
Yeah, which is difficult. It's a real commitment.
The transition is the hard part. Once you've gotten through the transition, it's not terribly onerous to farm organically.
Mm-hmm.
But the transition is really difficult because you're counting on healthy systems and they're not there. And yet you can't go to the what you used to know as crop protection. Similar to what we saw in Yegan when that life was lost. In that transition process, the life hasn't returned yet. And it's the life that protects the crops.
Yes, and it's the diversity. It's not having a single thing to manage a particular problem.
Yeah.
It's the range. Although you certainly do know about a number of, you know, key solutions for particular problems. Talk about the final moment when it all came together. You filed your alternative organic mitigation plan and numerous other documents, of course. People were coming out of the woodwork, professors in soil ecology and so on from the university, and saying, well, we'll be expert witnesses for you. And these are people volunteering their time, whereas usually you have to hire expert witnesses. It's expensive. And then what happens?
The last business day before the public hearing, the pipeline company approached our attorney and wanted us to sign a stipulation that they wouldn't cross the land and agreeing to adopt the organic mitigation plan. And I really didn't believe it was real. Because, you know, you get so dog on a bone, there ain't nothing going to stop you when you get in that state. And I thought, oh, it's a ploy so that we won't be prepared.
Yeah, you've got.
But it wasn't a ploy.
You said
they did want us to sign the agreement, and it was a great agreement. They gave us everything we wanted.
Amazing.
And so we signed that before. But I wasn't even, I didn't have to sign it. My attorney went and signed it. It was the Friday before Labor Day, and Labor, that's the biggest produce order of the year for us. So I was chained to the tomato sorting table in the pack line. Metaphorically, not literally chained, but
good.
Paula went and signed the agreement, and I just really didn't feel any celebration. I think I was so exhausted at that point, I couldn't even fathom that we had actually accomplished what we had set out to do.
When did it hit you, or was there no moment of recognition?
You know, it really took a good month, and it was a hailstorm in November. Where I was still just really, like, holding on to having to fight them. I don't know if you've ever been in a position where you really have to just hang on to that fight. And I couldn't really let go of it. And in a sense, it wasn't over because we still had to stay engaged, even though we had a signed agreement. We had to file documents for the record that would support the agreement because otherwise someone else could come along and say it wasn't a fair agreement. We still had to continue to engage in the legal process, and that is so important for people to know when they do these fights, is that they have to follow that legal process, whatever it is, even if it's a bad process and they don't like the process, follow the process. You can change the process later. But in the middle of the fight is not the time.
Yeah, and Paula made that clear to you. Yeah. So finally, a hailstorm of all things. Why? Why? Why did this help?
Hail just seems so ridiculous to me. Like, why do we have hail? It's so just balls of ice being pelted out of the sky.
Yeah, what benefit?
What is this all about?
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the book is about empowerment for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much
and
so.
And it's why I included the story of my first marriage, because I needed the reader to understand the change in me as a character.
Mm-hmm.
From a woman who tolerated 5 years of physical abuse to a woman who took on the largest privately owned company in the world.
Yeah.
That's a really big change.
Yeah.
And some of that change happened before the coke industry, and some of it happened in the middle of it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even realize after 20-some years of farming that I was an expert in organic farming. And there, you know...
Well, then you did realize.
At some point. Yeah, there was a revelation that I could speak up. And a lot of the book is really about that empowerment. I wanted women to have the opportunity to go through that experience with me and become empowered themselves.
Yeah, because the first...
society, women don't always claim their power. And we give it away.
Yeah, the first thing you did when you got the letters was you ran out to Martin. And you said, call them, do something.
I'm so embarrassed. I ran down to my husband. I expected him to call them. And he just looked at me and said, you tell him. You have all the answers.
You're the one who's all fired up here.
And I said, well, they'll listen to you better. You're a man. And it really, the pipeline was my final ability to really reverse those decades long of social messaging that women are not able to do things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you certainly went out and did it.
It's certainly not true that women can't do things like that. And I, in many ways, was much more capable of doing it than Martin. But I had to learn that.
Mm-hmm.
And I really get excited when I talk to young women today because they don't seem to have as heavy of a internalized message about women's roles and abilities in society.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're little powerhouses, whereas it took me, you know, 30 years to learn that.
But you did. You very much so did. So they caved, and this hailstorm comes along, and you and Martin are listening to that. This is November, so it's not going to do any damage, right?
That's true. But to any farmer, a hailstorm, it just brings up so many emotions because there's so many times you've laid in bed in the night and heard that hail hitting the tin roofs, ping, 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 and your heart just stops.
Yeah, it's very frightening. And you've got a wonderful bit there where you say you're just lying in bed and laughing while this hail comes.
And that was really that final moment of empowerment, of knowing that bad things happen in life,
mm-hmm.
but I've thrived, and it really revealed for me my own resiliency right along with nature. Life is inherently renewable and resilient. The life force is about healing, and that's part of us, too, as human beings.
And thank goodness.
And this is important because people get so discouraged about global climate change and all these really big issues facing us as a society. We have the answers. And life is renewable. Organic farming is a great example. It solves so many of the problems that are facing the world today.
Yes, it doesn't just maintain, it restores.
Exactly. That is the life force. It's why we all love nature so much and have such a strong need to connect with it.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for talking with me and spreading it.
Well, bet. No problem there. But I want to thank you very much for the book and for your time here.
Thanks for having me.
Bye then. I've been talking with Atina Diffley, author of Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works, a remarkable new book, a memoir by an organic farmer. You can find her at atinadiffley.com. That's our show for this week. Be well and garden on.
Pulling weeds and picking stones. Man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, cause the time is close at hand. And grain for grain, the sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. And tune my body and my brain to the music from the land.